Chapter 28. Stabs at Peace. The proposals of the new Austrian Emperor, Charles I, were the most important. In 1916 the young monarch had just succeeded Franz Joseph, the emperor as old as Belgium, both were born in 1830. Thus Charles I had not been involved in any way in the unleashing of the war in 1914. He had little liking for the German Kaiser, his ally by chance. His two brothers-in-law, Princess Sixtus and Xavier of Bourbon-Parma, were fighting in the armies of the King of Belgium on the Western Front, against the Germans. Charles I was neither a reformer like Joseph II or a tactical genius like a Metternich. He was not very aware of political realities, but he was sincere and bursting with a goodwill that on occasion made him naive. He was profoundly honest, but of course honesty in politics seldom carries one very far. Charles I had no capable ministers at his side, or at least any he could trust. Berchtold, the clumsy bungler of July 1914, had been replaced by a gloomy-eyed Hungarian, and then by Count Czernin. The latter, sensing that everything was tottering beneath him and that Charles I himself was headed for a fall, proved unreliable. Charles I had an intense desire for peace, a twofold peace, domestic peace, by granting to each of the separate nationalities Czech, Slav, Hungarian, and German an equal area and an autonomy of very broad rights, and peace with foreign countries as well. The young emperor was not only prepared to renounce all annexations, despite the fact that Serbia and Romania were then in the hands of the Austro-German forces, but was also ready to grant his Balkan adversaries important territorial concessions. To Italy, too, which up to then had achieved little on the battlefield, he would cede the Italian-speaking part of the Tyrol. To Serbia, responsible for the assassination of the Austrian crown prince, but now thoroughly whipped, its government having taken refuge at Corfu, he was willing to grant broad access to the Adriatic Sea. Generous almost to the point of naivete, Charles I was ready to offer still more to the Allies, who at that time were at a decided disadvantage on every front. Taking the initiative of offering peace was fraught with risk for Charles. The Germans were watching him, and they were much stronger than he was. They had the power to crush Austria in 24 hours. Up to then, the Austrians had been dependent on the constant help of the Germans. Left on their own in 1914, they had been beaten in Serbia, indeed chased out of Belgrade. It had required the intervention of German and Bulgarian divisions to send Pašić packing off to Corfu in the Adriatic. In Galicia, when Brusilov had overrun them, captured 25,000 kilometers of territory, taken hundreds of thousands of prisoners, and been on the point of bursting through into Hungary, it was the German army again that had saved the Austrians from disaster. Even in Romania, it was General Mackensen who had conquered Bucharest, not an Austro-Hungarian general. The Germans thus had some rightful claims on the regime in Vienna, all the more so because without the untimely steps of Austria in 1914, Germany almost certainly would not have been dragged into the war. By running the risk of antagonizing the Kaiser, Charles I showed commendable courage. The Allies should surely have given immediate consideration to these actions on the part of Charles I, especially since he had not entrusted the negotiations to dubious underlings, but to his own brothers-in-law, who were officers in the Allied armies. The Emperor sent his meddlesome mother-in-law, Maria Josepha, to Neuchâtel in Switzerland to meet her two sons, Sixtus and Xavier de Bourbon-Parma, and to charge them with the imperial peace mission. An offer to meet made to enemies does not necessarily obligate one side to reveal its hand, to commit itself in advance, and list its concessions, while the other remains silent and presents a countenance as inscrutable as the Sphinx. The two Belgian officers upon whom the Emperor was ready to rely had brought along preliminary demands drafted by the Allies which were very severe, indeed almost insolent in the light of the fact that the French and the British had just suffered terrible defeats in Artois, in Flanders, and in Champagne, and had left several hundred thousand men lying dead on the battlefield. The preparatory position of the Entente was brutally frank. Any conditions preliminary to a peace acceptable to the Entente must include the following indispensable demands. The restitution of Alsace-Lorraine to France without compensation of any kind on the latter's part. The re-establishment of Belgium. The restoration of Serbia with the addition of Albania. The restoration of Constantinople to Russia. These were enormous demands, which Charles I had to accept before negotiations could be admitted even in principle. The more so in that in 1916 no part of Alsace-Lorraine had yet been reconquered by the French. On the contrary, the Germans were occupying the 10 wealthiest departments of France. Moreover, the Serbians no longer had possession of a square centimeter of their territory, and the Russians had been unable to send a single warship to Constantinople, while the Allies had been completely thwarted when they tried to reach the city by way of the Dardanelles. The astonishing thing was that amid all these considerable claims, there was not the slightest allusion to the booty the Italians were to get, although the Allies, by the secret Treaty of London in 1915, had nonetheless promised them the Tyrol and millions of new citizens in Europe and Asia. Nor was there any question of what the Albanians might think about being delivered to the Serbians, or the Turks about being delivered to the Russians. It was a demand that the peoples of the Adriatic and the Bosphorus merely be put on the block, and not be consulted at all. Where, then, were the famous self-determination principles which had been trumpeted so virtuously? Charles I did not allow himself to be discouraged in the face of these exaggerated demands. He sent a reply which was in large measure an acceptance to the two princes, who returned to Neuchâtel. He was in agreement with regard to Alsace-Lorraine and Belgium. With regard to the territory of the South Slavs occupied by his troops, he proposed the creation of an autonomous kingdom consisting of Bosnia-Herzegovina, Austrian territory before 1914, Serbia, by then already captured, Albania, and Montenegro, existing on its own, but within the framework of an Austrian federation which for centuries has proven its worth as a unifying body. That last proposal was not final. It could be discussed. The function of a conference is discussion. Emperor Charles I had been conciliatory in the extreme. His initial concessions were enormous, since he was a member of a military coalition in a victorious position dealing with an Allied military coalition which in 1916 had reaped nothing but humiliating and terribly bloody defeats from Flanders to Gallipoli. But he was unaware that the Allies he was appealing to were bound by a series of secret and often contradictory treaties which bound them to deliver extravagant spoils to their confederates. No honest negotiations could alter these arrangements. Prince Sixtus, after several trips back and forth to Neuchâtel, saw Poincaré in Paris. He got in touch with Briand as well. After meeting those two, Xavier and Sixtus, and went to see Emperor Charles I in person. In great secrecy and at great risk, Charles went to meet his two brothers-in-law in Luxembourg, two Belgian officers in civilian clothes, in territory occupied by the Germans. The Allies still believed then, March 22 to 23, 1917, that they would win the Battle of Artois, where instead they were about to be ground up like a round of beef. "I want peace, I want it at any price," said the young Emperor of Austria-Hungary. He declared himself willing, after the initial basis of agreement had been reached with the Allies, to put as much pressure as he could on Wilhelm II to take part in the negotiations. Otherwise, he would not hesitate to sign a separate peace. Charles I would go yet further. Verbal offers might be misinterpreted or even disbelieved. He seated himself at a desk and there, in the town of Luxembourg, where he risked at any moment being found out and seeing brothers-in-law arrested, wrote on March 24, 1917 a three-page letter committing his proposals to paper. In that handwritten letter, Charles I heaped civilities upon his adversaries. "The traditional bravery of the French army is admirable," he wrote. He felt deep sympathy for France. It was just to give her back Alsace-Lorraine. Belgium's rights must be fully restored. As for Serbia, he was no longer speaking of a federation but was ready to accord her not only complete independence, but equitable and natural access to the Adriatic as well as broad economic concessions. All that Austria asked was that Serbia, enlarged and enriched at her expense, should no longer tolerate on her soil such anti-Austrian criminal organizations as the Black Hand, which had been so conspicuous at Sarajevo. This was an entirely understandable request. Paschik would be so impressed by the scope of these proposals that he would send emissaries to Switzerland to discuss them. To soften up the Austrians, he would even have his ex-confederate, Colonel Dmitrievich, shot. The document written by Charles I, which was a potentially decisive consequence to Europe, is now available to the world. Delaunay, the famous Belgian historian, has published it in its entirety. Had it been taken into consideration in 1917, the lives of several million people might have been saved, and Central Europe would not have become the white world's great land of injustice in 1919, and the most menacing colonial territory of the USSR 26 years later. On March 31, 1917, Prince Sixtus saw Poincaré again. Poincaré continued to equivocate, but nevertheless thought he could no longer leave his allies in ignorance of the facts. At that time the French president of the council there were four different ones in 1917 up to the time Clemenceau came in and cleaned house was Alexander Ribot. He was an old fellow, whose nerves were shot. He peered owlishly at anyone he was talking to from behind glasses as yellow as a couple of lemons, which he was forever wiping clumsily. What he feared most was not the Germans, but that his own parliament that might lash out at him. The announcement of peace negotiations meant risking a parliamentary rebuke. What if they turned his old bones out of the presidential chair? He refused to see Prince Sixtus, despite his being an allied officer and the bearer of peace. It was still necessary, however, to inform the allies and warn Lloyd George. There the terms of the problem were already completely changed. For Britain, what counted was not Strasbourg, or Brussels, or the Dalmatian coast, it was the German fleet and the German colonies. Charles I had not included them in his basket of gifts. Then, there were the Italians. On April 18, 1917, at Saint Jean de Maurienne, Lloyd George and Ribot had confirmed and amplified the 1916 Treaty of London. They'd had to deal with Minister Sannino. The only thing that interested Sannino in a peace with Austria was getting Trentino, Trieste and the eastern shore of the Adriatic. That was what the French and the British had promised Italy to induce her to enter the war. Nothing less would satisfy her. The indefatigable Prince Sixtus started off on his way again to a meeting with an envoy of Charles I at Zug, in Switzerland, and a second meeting at Lausanne. Finally, though an allied officer, he proceeded secretly to Vienna on May 8, 1917 to see Emperor Charles. From the Hofburg he brought back the Emperor's agreement drafted by the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Count Czernin, accepting the principle of an exchange of territories with Italy. So an initial proposal was offered there as well. Sannino, with his considerable cleverness, was trying for further concessions, which as a matter of fact had already been offered in 1915, when Prince von Bülow had attempted to halt Italy's entry into the war. That was not the tragedy. Charles I had asked that in exchange for numerous concessions he be guaranteed the integrity of what would be left of Austria after losing at least Bosnia-Herzegovina, Trieste, and Trentino. The naive emperor did not suspect that powerful Masonic and anti-clerical forces within the French government did not intend Austria-Hungary, the most important Catholic country of Europe, to be in existence after the hostilities. Secret agreements had already been made that would carve her up, dismember her provinces, and barter away millions of her inhabitants. Once this basis of agreement is accepted, Charles I reiterated to Prince Sixtus, Austria-Hungary will be able to sign a separate peace. Were there any obstacles? Yes, there were. The French translation made by the prince was questionable, it did not seem to correspond to the text of Vienna drafted in German. It was possible that Prince Sixtus had embellished the offer a bit, which negotiators are apt to do, but such misunderstandings were usual at the start of negotiations. Negotiations were made to remedy such things, to make everything clear. On the Allied side, especially on the side of the French, everything could easily and rapidly be brought into harmony. But Ribot had clamped his big yellow spectacles onto his nose. He was going to sabotage everything. Why? In a month it would be clear. Sixtus proceeded to London. He saw Lloyd George and the King, and discussed the limits of the possible peace, Germany included. or a separate peace with Austria alone. To decide that, Lloyd George proposed a meeting between the British and the French at Compiègne. That Allied conference would never take place. France would not reply, and consequently Britain would not attend. Ribaud had done his best to scuttle it even before Lloyd George set out on his journey. He had hoisted himself up on his creaky old limbs at the rostrum of the French Assembly to launch this cowardly and provocative denunciation. They will come to ask peace, not hypocritically as they do today in this shifty and circuitous manner, but openly and on terms worthy of France, applause. Hypocritically and in a shifty manner were strong words, and the Austrian Emperor himself and officers of the Belgian army had offered everything and risked everything with naive sincerity. Thus the French minister publicly committed an infamous deed, not only offering a scarcely disguised insult to Charles I, but informing the Emperor of Germany that his fellow monarch of Austria-Hungary had proposed peace negotiations to the Allies behind his back. A bit later Clemenceau would go still further. The unfortunate Charles I, in order to escape the wrath of William II, issued the denial that is standard in diplomatic affairs. Clemenceau, when he had become president of the council, would read to the assembly Charles's secret letter with the obvious aim of creating a fatal estrangement between his two enemies. It was a base move that wrecked any chance of future peace negotiations with Austria. Why did Ribaud, that old malefactor, as Prince Sixtus would call him, and Clemenceau after him, allow themselves to sink so low? In the first place, they were no longer in a position to discuss an equitable peace, since half a dozen secret treaties, signed by their colleagues and the British, had put up for auction some hundreds of thousands of square kilometers of Europe and tens of millions of her people. Only an overwhelming victory would make it possible for them to honor their commitments. Any other issue of the war would bring them insoluble problems, starting with the delection of their dearly bought allies. Austria was also the target of a relentless conspiracy, that of Freemasonry, for two centuries a mortal enemy of that vast Catholic country. Freemasonry wanted Austria-Hungary's hide, wanted it rend, lacerated, in pieces. Ribaud was one of the most important figures in French Freemasonry. Benes, the Czech, was the most important figure in the Freemasonry of Central Europe. He laid claim to the entire northern part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire with such voracity that in 1919, with the masonry of the entire world behind him, he would swallow up more non-Czechs than Czechs. Precisely at the very moment of these negotiations, a World Congress of Freemasons met in Paris, the seat of the sinister Grand Orient, on June 28, 1917 to create a society founded on the eternal principles of Masonry. Austria-Hungary was the exact opposite of that society. During the latter part of June 1917 in Paris, Freemasonry passed a death sentence on Austria-Hungary, proclaiming that minimum conditions of peace required the independence of Bohemia and the liberation of the diverse nationalities of Austria-Hungary, goals which could not be realized without the annihilation of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Just 3 days before the rabidly anti-Catholic Masonic Congress had been held, Ribaud had been bent on bringing about the downfall of Charles I. Ribaud's speech, indeed, had been the foreword to it. It was the choice appetizer preceding the banquet at which the conspirators of the left would devour Catholic Austria-Hungary, prepared for them in advance with malignant gloating by old Ribaud. Astonishingly, the Germans, who might well have considered themselves justified in angrily reproaching Austria-Hungary, their ally, for having secretly treated with the enemy, were extremely reserved in their protests. Why? Because they had done the same thing. Two officers of the Belgian army had been the liaison agents of Charles I. By a strange coincidence, the agents of the Reich were Brussels civilians. Both of them had been warmly encouraged, and at the same time, by King Albert I, the same who had been anxious to give his support to the socialist Camille Huysmans when he, as president of the Second International, was endeavoring to call a peace conference at Stockholm. After the war, the Belgian king was everywhere held to have been the model ally. A statue was erected to him at Paris, in which the warrior faithful beyond all others was advancing on horseback towards victory. In truth, King Albert distrusted the war aims of the Allies from the first day of the war to the last. He never allied himself with them completely. He wished to remain in his historic role of a neutral, knowing history had taught him well the cupidity of both sides, which were always ready to occupy and use his country. Even in 1914 he had refused to join up with the routed French and British armies in the south. On the contrary, he had withdrawn in the direction of Antwerp. After the autumn of 1914 he had clung to the Isar, a little Belgian stream, stubbornly refusing to leave his country. He did not believe a single perfidious word of the fine speeches of the Allies, liberty, justice, rights of man, which they used to cover up their own interests. He had no choice but to be guided solely by the interests of his country. The interest of Belgium, wedged between two powerful nations, and to whom foreign wars could bring nothing but grief, could only be peace. Albert I had let his two officers of Bourbon-Parma travel to Switzerland, to Luxembourg, to Vienna, to London, and to Paris. He had seen them return empty-handed. However, another possibility had arisen, this one stemming from the Germans and launched in Brussels, his occupied capital. The new negotiations involved, on the Belgian side, three principles. The first was Cardinal Mercier, the primate of Belgium. He was a tall, emaciated philosopher, a sovereign spirit, of supreme dignity and majesty. As a young student, I would be discovered by him. He was my first teacher. I still see him scrutinizing me, bright-eyed like a watching bird, majestic despite his gauntness, like a Michelangelo prophet. The second negotiator was a French woman, a Rochefoucauld become Belgian through her marriage to a member of the House of Merode, in 1914 headed by a count, today by a prince. The third was a man of business, the Benzine King of Belgium, Baron Evens Coppée. The German who would be the decisive element in these other secret, semi-official negotiations was the Baron van der Lancken. As an embassy attaché, he had known the young Paul de la Rochefoucauld. The fortunes of war gained him a key post in the military administration of Belgium. The Countess of Merode, concerned for all who suffered the misfortunes or the rigors of the occupation, had many a time spoken to van der Lancken, much as she had done in Paris before the hostilities. In particular, she had got him to accept a petition from Cardinal Mercier requesting pardons for two men negotiations. Their envoy was officially authorized to make an initial pardon 17, every Belgian then awaiting execution. It was thus that the Belgian primate, wishing to thank the German diplomat, had gone to see him at the home of the Countess de Merode. Then, for the first time, they spoke of the possibility of re-establishing peace. The cardinal challenged the representative of the Reich to assist in negotiations between Germany and the Allies. The German took the cardinal at his word and set off for Berlin. In October 1916 he saw the cardinal again, who, after hearing him, expressed his dissatisfaction. A new trip to Berlin at the beginning of 1917 resulted in a meeting at Bad Kreuznach between the Chancellor of the Reich, the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, Marshal von Hindenburg, and General Ludendorff. This select assembly, at the end of April 1917, agreed to the concession of certain territories of the Reich southwest of Alsace and in French-speaking Lorraine. It wasn't yet at the point of the French army entering Metz to the sound of trumpets, but a trend was taking shape. It must not be forgotten that in the spring of 1917, the Germans had the upper hand, yet they were prepared to cede some territory. When I made contact with the government of the Reich, Lancken later wrote, it appeared straight off that Berlin attached the greatest importance to this endeavor. Chancellor von Bethmann-Hollweg and the secretary gave me encouragement at every point. A more astonishing piece of information. It was the same with Field Marshal von Hindenburg and with General Ludendorff, otherwise so difficult to approach. As is fitting to note at once, during the entire course of this affair General Ludendorff never failed to ask for information about it and concerned himself with the success of what I was doing. That was not, to be sure, total approval, but it was the manifestation of a desire on the part of the Germans to negotiate. When during the entire course of the war was there any such attitude on the part of the Allied authorities? When did a French or British politician or military man ever make a similar gesture? The Germans might have said no for fear of having their enemies say that they had realized they were going to lose the war. Yet, even before the negotiations, there was envoy officially authorized to make an initial concession unconditionally. A clever negotiator, once he had that thread in his hands, would no doubt pull out more of the skein. The name of that negotiator was even mentioned. Baron van der Lancken had indicated he would begin the negotiations between the Germans and the Allies with one of his Paris acquaintances from before the war, a man who was surely the most ingratiating politician in France, Briand. Between the two world wars, Aristide Briand became the best-known French politician in Europe, his voice grave and softly harmonious, his mustaches hanging down like a drooping bush, poorly dressed in skimpily made business suits, and dropping ashes everywhere from his everlasting cigarettes. In June 1917, he had resigned from his position of prime minister 3 months too soon. Despite that, he could be the perfect unofficial delegate of the Allied authorities. The Countess de Merode, having obtained a passport from van der Lancken, left for Paris, where she immediately met with Briand. She delivered a proposal for an interview with Lancken in Switzerland. Briand immediately went, on June 19, to confer with Poincaré. The latter was not very enthusiastic. Nevertheless, he authorized Briand to see van der Lancken. Meanwhile, a second Belgian démarche had given impetus to the action of the princess at Paris. A second emissary had arrived in France to further support van der Lancken's proposals. He had not wanted to act, however, without first receiving the consent of the head of the Belgian government, M. de Broqueville, who, like his king, had taken refuge at Saint-Adresse, near Le Havre. He sent them the letter from van der Lancken, offering to meet with an allied emissary. Briand, Coppée, and Broqueville planned to meet in Paris at the Ritz. Broqueville was affirmative, the German proposals are of a serious nature. Briand was impressed. He made up his mind and got ready. But alas, France was a democracy, the Ribaud government fell. A new government was formed by Painleve, a confused but honest mathematician, who was better at juggling logarithms and hypotenuses than diplomatic subtleties. It was necessary to start preparing the way all over again. Coppée, Briand, Poincaré, and the new prime minister weighed the possibility of negotiation. "We have to go all the way," Painleve concluded. Poincaré was still cool to the idea, but didn't oppose it. He was a man who rarely stood in opposition to things. He cast his net, stood stock still, waited for the other party to get caught. Ribaud, who had already torpedoed the peace project with Emperor Charles I, remained in the cabinet as Minister of the Interior, which was not very reassuring. Briand outlined a plan of negotiations that went further than the German proposal, as was only to be expected. Instead of a part of Alsace-Lorraine, he laid claim to all of it, and he demanded war preparations as well. On the other hand, France will not raise the question of the left bank of the Rhine nor the political and economic freedom of the German people. As in poker, both of the two parties had thoroughly studied their cards. The obstacles presented were by no means insurmountable. This sort of preliminary was usual in even the most modest negotiations. Coppée, informed before returning to Brussels, saw van der Lancken. Briand himself proposed September 22, 1917 as the date of the meeting in Switzerland. Coppée confirmed to him in writing the confidence he now had in their success. "This turn of events had given the Countess de Merode and me an absolute conviction that Germany is ready to make the greatest possible concessions, so that the withdrawal from the occupied territory, indemnities and reparations, as well as the restitution of Alsace-Lorraine to France, may be envisaged with a virtual certainty of success." Coppée had reason to express these views. On September 11, 1917, the Kaiser himself had presided over a meeting at the Imperial Palace of Bellevue, decisions of which went far beyond the concessions granted at Bad Kreuznach. All the top military and civilian leaders had attended the meeting. The Germans, needless to say, were not going to give up everything before their emissary had even talked to Briand. But if Van der Lancken was to be believed, they would have gone a long way. My plan, he explained in his memoirs, page 223, was to get Bryant, by the manner in which I listened to him, to lay out his views as plainly as possible, and to a certain extent to learn his final price. Then to get to Berlin the fastest way, press for an immediate answer, and get it back to Bryant in Switzerland with all possible speed. Delaunay, the Belgian historian, who scrutinized with a magnifying glass every passage of the dossier and interviewed every possible witness, sums up the convictions of the Kaiser's unofficial emissary. Lancken assured Coppe and the Countess de Merode that he had received orders to conclude the peace and that if the proposals he was charged to make to Bryant were deemed insufficient, he would immediately ask Berlin for new instructions. Histoire de la diplomatie secrète, page 84. He would later add, given the weariness of the belligerents, a solution could have been found to the problem of Alsace-Lorraine. On September 21, 1917, the eve of the meeting with Bryant, Baron van der Lancken detrained at Auchy-Lausanne and put up at the Hotel du Château. The Countess de Merode and Baron Coppe were already in town, at the Beau Rivage Hotel. Lancken, Delaunay explains, expressed his conviction that the proposed interview would be favorable to a peaceful decision. He confirmed to them that he'd had contact with the German General Staff again and that the negotiations were beginning auspiciously. The meeting of the next day was to take place at the villa of a French general who was a friend of Bryant. They waited in vain for Bryant to arrive. On September 23, Baron van der Lancken, empty-handed, took up his valise, shocked at this evasion on the part of the French negotiator, without an excuse or even an explanation. It was Ribaut, the Freemason, who had made it all miscarry. With honeyed words he had put the question to the British government, wouldn't it be a good idea to avoid the trap set for M. Bryant? What reply could the Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom have given except that it was necessary to avoid falling into a trap? What trap? As with Vienna's proposal, the German proposal had been properly and courageously brought forward by impeccable intermediaries under the aegis of the Allied government of Belgium. What seems to us unspeakable, Delaunay wrote, was Poincaré's weakness, Ribaut's bad faith. Millions of men were still to die for two Alsatian fortresses. All the attempts for peace which were still to follow, including the one entrusted to Nolens, the French ambassador at St. Petersburg, would routinely miscarry, one after another. The plans of Freemasonry were to be pursued implacably, however great the massacre. Germany and Austria-Hungary were to be annihilated.